Hello and welcome to Physics Frontiers, episode number 76, Undecidability and Theories of Everything, with Klaus Kiefer. Professor Kiefer is at the Institute for Theoretical Physics at the University of Cologne. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/76. Show notes will include the article that Dr. Kiefer wrote that we're talking about here, as well as related episodes of Physics Frontiers and various other things we mention in the podcast. And now, Dr. Kiefer.
Well, hello, Klaus. How are you doing?
Oh, fine. Thank you. Nice to see you, Jim. So we're talking about final theories.
So talk about final theories. Okay. Oh, now that sounds a little scary already. Okay. So what I would like to talk about is this paper here, Gödel's Undecidability Theorems and the Search for a Theory of Everything. This is an essay. This was for an essay contest, right?
Essay contest, of the circle of people who devote themselves to the work of Gödel. I think it's based in Germany. And every 2 years, they have such a competition. And last year, I mean, the topic was about fundamental theories and about physics. So where these theorems could play a role. I think earlier on, there was a topic on time, because Gödel also wrote on time, actually, and whether time exists or not. But this time, it was on physics. So I started actually then to think about a problem when I heard about that competition. I mean, to think about whether there is a final theory of everything in physics. Some call it the theory of everything. And if yes, whether we can really decide whether if we have a candidate, whether that's the theory or not. I mean, it could be that there is no such final theory. It could be that there is one and we have it at hand and we can calculate in principle everything, or it could be that it's there but we cannot really do much out of it because there are many undecidable statements. So I started to think about it, because I think most of my colleagues do not really think that Gödel's theorems are relevant in this. And the outcome of this and of the essay is, yes, it seems that that's what I suggest, that there are really undecidability problems in the construction of such a final theory, at least if space-time is a continuum. So I concluded with the maybe provocative statement that if space-time fundamentally is discrete, so we could really, I mean, count it, then there's a chance of really having the theory and using it as a final theory, and it's not undecidable, or there's a continuum, and we will always face problems that go under the name of continuum hypothesis and undecidability. So that's the outcome of that essay. And I presented then the arguments by going through history, but also through the mathematics and the connection with quantum theory, in particular quantum gravity, which is behind the search for a theory of everything.
Yeah, excellent. So we're looking at this, and you're saying that if space-time is discrete, we might be able to determine that there is a final theory.
That's what I put as a suggestion, or also to the community as the main result of the essay.
So I know in the preamble I said I didn't want to do this, but I mean, as you are an expert in quantum gravity, you have a book on quantum gravity itself, right? So I might want to just ask, to what extent is quantum gravity talking about discrete points? And perhaps you had lots of different proposals for quantum gravity. So are there some quantum gravities that would have discrete points and others that would not, and stuff like that, just to talk a little bit about that? Because quantum gravity, general relativity, it's as much a theory of space-time as of gravity, right? It tells us more than just, you know, two objects are attracted to each other, right? So it's actually much deeper than that, much more fundamental to the way the world is put together. So could you talk a little bit about that so that people have an idea that, you know, about how likely is it that the world is made up of discrete points?
Yes, let me try. I mean, gravity in our modern way of thinking, and this goes back to Einstein, 1915, gravity is a manifestation of the geometry of space-time. So it's no longer as it was in Newton's days, as you mentioned. So they're just an attraction of two masses at a distance, at infinite speed. Now it's a geometry of space-time at a point locally where gravity acts. So geometry and gravity can be used synonymously. I mean, the famous American physicist John Wheeler, he coined the name geometrodynamics for general relativity, which is a better name. It's the dynamics of geometry, as electrodynamics is the dynamics of the electromagnetic field. So only for historic reasons do we use relativity. So it's geometry. Now in Einstein's theory, we have a model for that geometry. A technical term is called manifold, but one can envisage this as a continuum. If you think of, say, in two dimensions surfaces, then it's generalized to four dimensions, where three are spatial dimensions, where we move here in, and one is time. But in relativity, this is a continuum. There you cannot talk about a smallest point, or you cannot count a point. It's a continuum modeled by the real numbers. So the question is whether this remains when we go to a more deeper level. So what does it mean to go to a more deeper level? I mean, we have Einstein's theory, gravity. This is called a classical theory. It's not quantized, it's non-quantum. But all the other interactions that we know and talk about in physics, they are described by what we call a quantum theory. Now, in the word quantum, there seems to be the discrete nature already put in, but it's not the discrete nature of space-time. So the word quantum comes historically from the fact that certain spectra are discrete. So if you have energies and you can observe that in the laboratory, you have these discrete lines. And so this is where the quantum comes from. So space and space-time, traditionally in quantum theory, also were continuum. So we have this Einstein theory, which is not quantum, and we have all the rest that is quantum, and the rest means, fundamentally, it's the electromagnetic interaction and these microscopic interactions, which we call weak interaction and strong interaction. They're responsible for having the nuclei together in the atoms and also for radioactive decays. They are described successfully by a theory. Particle physicists call it a standard model of particle physics. So in many places around the world, for example, in CERN in Geneva, at the Large Hadron Collider, this is studied and confirmed to all precision that we know. So we have these two theories. And the question is that the end? Do we have to live with these? It seems that all experiments, observations can be described by general relativity and standard model, or do we have to go beyond? And the question which we discussed today is only relevant when we go beyond, because if we ask the question, is there a final theory of physics, a unified theory where everything in principle can be derived from? Now, relativity is in a sense not complete. This is independent of Gödel's theorems. It's not complete because Penrose and Hawking and Gerosch and others have shown that there are so-called singularities in space-time. If Einstein's theory is correct under general assumptions, which means that theory breaks down, for example, there's the so-called Big Bang, and it seems that this cannot be described by Einstein because you have an infinite expansion, and also the interior of black holes. Also, there seem to be some infinities. So an infinities mean breakdown of the theory. So the general expectation is that we have to go beyond, that this cannot be the final state. And so can we somehow find a general theory without singularities and without having, say, a classical side and a quantum side? Well, the general opinion is that if it's a general theory, it should be quantum, because everything except for gravity is already quantum. So we should somehow encompass or accommodate gravity into this unified quantum theory. But this is an open issue. So you have already talked about or mentioned this quantum gravity approaches. So there are various approaches. And in some of them, we have indications for discrete nature of space-time. In others, we do not yet have. So for example, the most conservative approach is just to take Einstein's theory and apply rules of, we call it quantization. These are heuristic rules, so on paper, that we try to develop a quantum version of Einstein that, of course, then has to be tested by experiment. And one of the oldest goes back to John Wheeler and Price DeWitt, of course, following earlier work by Bergman, Dirac, Arno Wendeser-Miesner. And this is quantum geometrodynamics. Quantum geometrodynamics, I should maybe make it brief, has not just space-time, but has what Wheeler calls a superspace, a space of all spaces. But for your question, this is still a continuum. It's not discrete. So we have this continuum nature, and with it, which I can explain later, this problem of with Goethe's undecidability. There is a more modern version of this approach. It's called loop quantum gravity. And there are indications, this approach, that space, there's only space, not space-time, space is discrete. At least there's a spectra of so-called geometric quantities. I mean, we know the spectra, the usual spectra of energies. And so these are spectra just in geometry that are fundamental, say, area. And then you only have, say, this area, twice that area, three times that area, four times, and so on. And continuum only is an illusion if you don't look carefully. So this loop seems to have this discrete nature. There's also another approach that is favored by many called string theory, which is very different. Because in string theory, you do not just take Einstein and make a quantum version out of it. No, you try to start from the very beginning with a quantum theory of all interactions. And gravity and all the other interactions that only emerge in a particular limit. So they are not there at a fundamental level. That's string or M theory. And the peculiar thing, you also have not only three or four dimensions, but you have 10 or 11 dimensions that you cannot, most of which you cannot see, of course, because you and I, we can only see three space and one time. Now, it seems that in string theory, and at least in most approaches, it's not yet a completed theory, we also encounter continua, not discrete manifolds, but a continuum. I don't want to go into too many technical things, but there are specialists call it Calabi-Yau manifolds, for example, or others. Whatever that is, the listeners do not have to know that, but it's a continuum, so it's not a discrete. So, yeah, maybe I stop and maybe you can ask me questions.
That's good. So we have at least one quantum gravity theory, quantum gravity theory that has a lot of people working on it, that does have a discrete space-time, or at least discrete points of space-time. And we have at least one that has a continuum. So that is not even decided, or
it's undecided. We do not know, and the main reason for not knowing is the lack of experiments.
Mm-hmm.
It's very different from, I think, most of history of modern physics, because their experiment and theory went hand in hand. Now we go a little bit ahead in theory, so we have many more or less complex constructions, ingenious constructions, but we hardly have an experiment. Depending on whom you ask, people say there is absolutely no experiment, or maybe there are some observational hints that come from cosmology, because in the laboratory, things are very difficult. But in cosmology, that gives you a window to the early universe. There was this WMAP satellite and this Planck satellite that flew 10 or 20 years ago, and they measured what is called the cosmic microwave background. And in fluctuations of this cosmic microwave background, there may also be hidden hints of quantum gravity in the early universe. But if at all, this is only at a so-called linearized limit, and it does not yet give you the opportunity to discriminate between all these approaches. So at the moment, I'm afraid this is mainly a theoretical work. So, and theoretical work means there are different schools and different opinions, different principles. And yes, as I agree, some of them claim at least there's discrete feature of space. And others, it seems it's a continuum. So it's undecided. The reason is lack of observation so far. And the interesting question is, of course, whether we can have observations in the future. So Richard Feynman, famous American theoretical physicist, he this book, I think it's called Laws, Nature of Physical Laws, The Nature of Physical Laws, a general book. I can really recommend to read it. There he speculates whether physics can go forever like this, searching for fundamental levels, or whether it comes at an end, to an end. And he was in that book that he wrote in the 1960s, amazingly pessimistic, because he wrote something like, we now live in a marvelous age where we discover fundamental law, but there may be a time when this is no longer possible, because we would need experiments too expensive to be done, or theory would be so complicated, would become so complicated that we no longer can do the calculations. And now, 50 or more years after Feynman wrote it, it's still like that. We don't know. Yeah. So I mentioned this accelerator at CERN, or there's in US various accelerators that are already about big, and thousands of people work at these accelerators. But to directly probe what we call the scale of quantum gravity, yeah, you would have to increase the size of this accelerator beyond the solar system. So I guess we agree that no budget is available, neither in the US nor in Europe, nor even in China, to have such big accelerators. So that's why it's not easy. You think about looking into the early universe with these cosmic satellites, but that's another. So it could be that Feynman is right, and that we have come to an end, or we have come to an end, and because we just cannot go further. Now, some say that string theory is a theory of everything, so that's already at hand. But I would doubt, because just of this lack of connection, not even lack of experiments, but also lack of connection to known physics, and to what I mentioned is the standard model. Yeah, so I mentioned my essay that according to a recent estimate of a string series, there are at least, 10 to the 270,000 possibilities to come from this higher dimensional world of string theory to our world where you sit in your office, and the physics there. And 10 to the 270,000 means, of course, that there's no chance. In our observable universe, there are only 10 to the 80, one with 80 serious particles. Mm-hmm. And so we will have 10 to the 270,000 options. I mean, you could not even describe that by using all atoms in our universe. Mm-hmm. So it seems that string theory, maybe it's a theory of everything, but it's far from being clear. So that's the situation how it is. And this is why I always emphasize in my research looking for effects and experiments of that is very important and should not be neglected compared to theoretical constructions, as important as they are.
Excellent, excellent. So I guess I've got a comment for the listeners, which is we have done episodes on the string theory landscape, which is basically what you were just talking about. We did an episode on loop quantum gravity, and we did an episode on deformed special relativity or doubly special relativity, which is this idea that there would be a discrete limit in space, right? In a flat space, you'd still have some sort of discrete limit there. I will put links up to those in the show notes. I'd also like to comment on The Character of Physical Law, the Feynman book that you're talking about. I believe that book is a transcription of the Messenger lectures. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't have it here. I think they are transcriptions of these lectures, yes.
So these lectures are also available on the internet for free. Yeah. But when I worked at a liberal arts college, one of these tiny little colleges we have in the United States with 2,000 students who, pay $50,000 a year to have six people in their upper division classes. In that situation, I was able to run a little book club. So I'd have like two books a semester. And when we ran through all of our students again, right, because, you get more students every year and then you lose a few every year because, that's the nature of colleges. I would read that book with them, right? So we'd go through and we'd read one of those chapters a week, because it's like six chapters for half a semester, and just discuss that book. It's really a wonderful book, and it goes through all sorts of things. And I think everybody who hasn't read it probably ought to pick it up and read it. And it was one of the more inspiring things I read as an undergraduate myself.
Yes, yes. That'd be fine.
Wonderful, wonderful. So now I think we have an even better idea about what you're doing than I expected we would have at this point. I think we have a really clear background picture about the physics stuff there. But we should talk a little bit about undecidability, right? And you wrote this for an essay contest about Kurt Gödel, or maybe about his work. And so could you discuss what these undecidability theorems are? Because we've kind of been saying undecidability in a very loose way. Whereas if you look at Gödel and the mathematicians who came after him, they had a very precise meaning. So do you think you could explain what undecidability means in that context?
Let me try. So what Gödel proved, and this was in 1931, so now almost a century ago, was that for a sufficiently complex mathematical system, sufficiently complex means that you can do at least calculations with the natural numbers. So 2 + 3 is 5 and all that. So sufficiently complex that there are statements that you can neither prove nor disprove. Now, I think we all had the mathematics in school, and we are four-year scientists at a university, and that we have seen that, okay, mathematical statements have either to be, we have to devise and prove, or we have to be give counter examples, and then it's this one counter example suffices, and then the statement is proven wrong. Now, what Gödel showed in a very complicated line of arguments is there's a third option, and this is then called undecided. Well, so we cannot, within a given so-called axiomatic framework dealing with numbers, mathematicians always, of course, have to use a given framework of axioms. And this framework, we cannot prove that if it were, okay, it's not 2 + 3 is 5, but something, this mathematical statement, whether this is really true or not. So even if you don't know much about mathematics, I think this should come to them as a big surprise, because we know about this idea of proving statements. Well, so Douglas Hofstadter, in this famous book, Gödel, Escher, Bach, that I'm not sure whether it's still being read, but when I was a student, this was, of course, obligatory reading for interested students. He formulated it as follows. I have the statement here, all consistent axiomatic formulations of number theory undecidable propositions. Now, when you look into Gödel's Orchard papers, then okay, you find nothing that you can directly understand, because he constructs statements that are undecidable by having self-referential ideas, but these are not statements that, I mean, have anything in common with mathematical theorems that we know. So it would seem from just reading this paper that this is maybe something relevant only for the most academic of all mathematicians, and not relevant for us mortal beings like physicists and so on. But this is not true. So there are many examples where this undecidability in fact plays a role. There is this halting problem of Alan Turing, which maybe we can discuss later, but also this what is called the continuum hypothesis, which is relevant, I think, for what I wrote in my essay. This continuum hypothesis. Okay, this is something very old. It goes back to a German mathematician called Cantor, who also developed set theory in the 19th century. And okay, let me try to explain in simple words. So, you know, there are numbers, natural numbers and integer numbers. There are also real numbers. So the integer numbers you can count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the natural number, sorry, and also the integer number, it's minus 1, minus 2. The other rational numbers, which is the fractions, the 1 half, 1 third, and so on, already Cantor has proved that you can count them. There's some complicated way you can map them 1 to 1 to the natural numbers, even if it's not intuitive. The point is, as soon as you deal with infinities, intuition is gone. Yeah, intuition is gone. You can prove a lot of counterintuitive things with infinite numbers like Hilbert's hotel and so on. But the rational numbers are also countable. Now, the next thing that people knew are the real numbers, not the square root of 2 or the number pi. And so these are not fractions. And so these are real numbers. And the question is whether you count them, you can count them or not. They are uncountable. So they cannot be counted. But the question is, the continuing hypothesis, whether there is a degree of, how should I say, countability between the one of the natural numbers and the real numbers, or whether the real numbers are the next complicated thing, in a sense, after the natural and rational numbers. That's the continuum hypothesis, and it's called continuum hypothesis because people at that time saw that the real numbers are a model of the continuum. That is the continuum, which is, say, a real line, and that every point of that real line is on that line is a real number. This is something, this is just an assumption. And in fact, I have learned already as a student that there is a so-called non-standard analysis, so modern way, modern field of mathematics, that says there are many more numbers on the real line than on the line than just the real numbers. So, but what the mathematician, famous mathematician Cohen in 1963 showed is that this continuum hypothesis is undecidable in the sense of Gödel. So it's a very famous question. So the famous mathematician Hilbert in 1900, he presented 23 important open problems in a world famous congress of mathematicians. And I think it was even the first open problem was this continuum hypothesis. And Hilbert thought, I mean, he was a classic mathematician, so-called formalist, he thought, okay, everything can be proven or disproved. I mean, there is no doubt about that for him. And it was clear to him, the continuum hypothesis will be proven or disproven at some point. And then Cohen, 63 years later, showed, no, that cannot be, it's undecidable, at least within the standard set of axioms. I mean, another point is, of course, whether you can generalize these axioms and then prove it in this wider set. But as Gödel showed, okay, even if this is possible in this wider set, you will have new statements that are undecidable. And then, I mean, like in this, this shells, you know, then you would have to go forever, I mean, to the next axiomatic system. So this continuum hypothesis is undecidable. So we actually don't know about the countability of the number. So if we really believe in a space-time continuum, then whether it's in string theory or in quantum geometric dynamics, then we have, I mean, somehow we have this undecidability connected with the continuum hypothesis, and with this infinities comes the undecidability of other statements. I might say these remarks on these undecidabilities in standard quantum mechanics. Well, in quantum, as I said, quantum mechanics means there's spectra of energies, you know, so ground state, excited state, and they can be discrete or they can be a continuum. Think about that there's a gap or no gap. So there's a ground state that the molecule can be in, and there's a first excited state. And there may be a gap, a certain amount of energy between the ground state and the first excited, or there may be no gap. And I was actually intrigued to learn when preparing my essay, only then, to learn that some 5, 6, 7 years ago, there were papers published where also showed that actually there are standard situations in these molecules, not quantum gravity or something very complicated, where you have energy situations where you cannot decide whether there is a gap or not. And so I thought, okay, if it's already in quantum mechanical systems, if we go then to quantum gravity, for example, in this equation that Wheeler and de Vit constructed in the 60s, it's also of that type. And if we have this problem with quantum mechanics, then it seems we have this problem too, even in the simplest of quantum gravity approaches that is based on the continuum. I mean, these proofs that I just mentioned of this undecidability in quantum mechanics, they make use of infinities of thermodynamic limit. These are technical terms. So I thought, oh, if already in those simple situations we have this problem, in quantum gravity, we have similar equations, though much more complicated. It seems to me we have the same. And if this is true, and if we have a continuum, then we cannot really decide about whether this is correct or not. So this is what led me to my statement, which is, of course, only a statement that people can discuss. So maybe it's true that only if we have a discrete situation that we don't face these all these infinities, which plague us so much also in already in classical general relativity, but also in the quantum theory of the standard model, where you have infinities coming from the very, very small. People who know about particle physics, they know that one has to struggle with mathematical expressions where you have infinity and infinity, and you have to what one calls to regularize it and to renormalize, and have to do a lot of mathematical tricks to get something definite. All of this would be gone if fundamentally space-time would be straight. So if, say, a theory of quantum gravity or theory of quantum interactions would be based on such discrete nature, then I could imagine, at least then it's not obvious that it's undecidable. It could still be that a theory is too complicated to make appropriate predictions, but at least in principle, it would be possible. Yeah, but what is often not so understood is that already in our physics right now, we have situations where we have more general theory that is responsible for everything in that field, but where we still cannot derive everything from it. A standard example is nuclear physics. That's the physics that describes the dynamics of constituents of atoms, the protons, the neutrons, and so on. And for example, to calculate spectra of these constituents, one employs models, so-called shell model or other models. Although we have in principle a theory, this theory is called quantum chromodynamics or QCD. It's a theory of the strong interactions, and everyone believes that this is the fundamental theory that in principle describes everything that has to do with nuclei. But the theory is complicated. Yeah, so there are things that even the best of all physicists cannot compute. And so the statement is in principle. We can in principle derive, say, nuclear spectra from quantum chromodynamics, but not in practice. So that could still be possible, even if the fundamental theory would be screened. But at least then we could say we have it, and in principle, we believe that everything, even the nuclear spectra and so on. So this is, I mean, the final dilemma, discrete versus continuous. And even if discrete, it could be complicated to derive everything. But in principle, we would have a final theory. And still, in practice, we would use model one and model two at this model. But we would be convinced that in principle, the theory is complete, but not with the continuum. There we can never be sure.
Okay, so... Well, that was a lot. You got into undecidability in physics, right, with the spectral gap problem, and that was done just a few years ago. And you ended with the QCD. One of the interesting things, I think this is the same thing that you mentioned in the essay, was you cannot show whether or not quarks are confined or not with QCDs. Is that correct? That's what the qubit paper said. Is that correct?
This is how I understand it, although I must confess that I have not followed the detailed derivation of the qubit paper. So, but if that paper is correct, and I have no doubt and no reason to doubt it. The statement is that you cannot prove it, which I found, I did not know about that. I learned about consignment when I was a student in the 1980s. And there we learned about so-called lattice gauge series, where numerically you could find indications that quarks are confined inside nuclei, so there cannot be free quarks, and that it's only a matter of time to prove it in QCD. But what I learned from the qubit paper, if that qubit paper is really correct, as I assume, but experts in QCD should of course decide about that, then it's not even decidable. So within QCD, so perhaps it's undecidable in a bigger framework, if he understands string theory as good enough to deal that, but it's not derivable within QCD. And okay, you see it, the theory exists for many decades. And at least to my knowledge, I'm not the founding of this, at least to my knowledge, there is nothing better than this lattice gate theory results, which are on the computer and which give indications that there is confinement, but not an analytic.
And the big deal there is, it's, I'll say, almost certainly correct, but you know, experimentally, we never see, you know, these individual quarks running around. So yes, the quarks definitely seem to be confined experimentally, but it looks like it's not a proposition that we can find a definitive proof in the theory, quantum chromodynamics, which is part of the standard model, which is, again, something everybody believes, right? So I assume everybody believes.
I think so.
That is not one of the more contentious areas of physics, right? Okay, so do you think you've explained how this sort of undecidability affects people's research? Do you see anything anywhere where this sort of idea would affect anybody's research at this point?
I think this is, of course, a question about the future. To my knowledge, at least, I may have overlooked something, but to my knowledge, this has not played a role so far in concrete work. I mean, I know the community in working in quantum gravity, but these undecidability issues have hardly played a role. I mean, I mentioned this, some few examples, which are not in unified theory, but just quantum gravity by Gerhardsch and Partl, in the so-called path integral approach, quantum gravity. This is a paper already of 1986. In my language, it means that it's an uncomputability. Yeah, so your so-called expectation values, average values of interesting physical quantities cannot be calculated from that path integral, because path integral in quantum gravity means you somehow solve over all four-dimensional geometries. I mean, four-dimensional geometry is what is behind Einstein's theory, but in quantum theory, you can, like as in Schrödinger's cat, now you can superpose all of these geometries at the same time, and four manifolds are uncountable. I mean, you enter, I think, the same problems as maybe in the Hawking problem or in others. You cannot just calculate. You cannot give to the computer the path integral and say, please compute the expectation value of my energy. Okay, given enough, maybe you have the most the powerful computer in the world, even in what is feasible, it's impossible. That's what Gerhardsch and Partl showed. So it has affected some researchers, but very few. I mean, I can count on one hand as in papers I know about this, which is, if you have these thousands of papers that are published on quantum gravity, unclinchable. So this is more or less a thing, was one intention of the essay, and I'm not sure whether my expectation will be fulfilled, that people are motivated by it to study the consequences of this undecidability. At least for me, it has already one consequence, because I was working over the last decades very much on this Wheeler-DeWitt approach, because this is one of the, if not the most conservative approach to quantum gravity. I think having such a conservative approach, you're on a much safer ground than if you just start from a speculation. And if you allow maybe a little bit more technical to say what I mean. There's this equation, and this equation had the structure h on psi is equal to zero. Now, h is the quantum version of the energy, but here gravity plus all other forms of energy together, and psi is the quantum theoretical wave function, but based on fundamental rule of circular probability amplitudes. But applying this on psi, h on psi is just zero. So in quantum mechanics, you have there something else with the time, but time is absent, and you have an equation as you have when you discuss the spectra of atoms and molecules, where instead of the zero, there is the energy values, but here you have this zero. And this equation only makes sense if this zero really is on part of the discrete spectrum, because otherwise you cannot handle this equation. But this seems to be in the light of these qubit papers that you mentioned, or this one seems to be an undecided question. So what should I do with this equation? Yeah, if I have, if I should show that zero is in the discrete spectrum, if it makes sense. But then I learn from this paper, and if I extrapolate for quantum gravity, which qubit is not that, then I learn that it's undecided. So what should I do? So you ask about the consequences for concrete research, and this would mean I have somehow to go beyond that framework and construct a more general equation. I don't know whether string theorists will be interested in this question about that. I mean, they are plagued by plenty of other problems with this 10 to the 70,000 options to go to the real world from the string theory. I mean, already that is painful and probably not possible. So I hope that the research is influenced by that. I mean, I have quoted Penrose. Maybe I find the quote here. I mean, Roger Penrose, I think it was a book on Road to Reality, where, if you allow me to read this quote, he writes, it is my own personal opinion that we shall find that computability issues will eventually be found to have a deep relevance to future physical theory, but only very little use of these ideas has so far been made in mathematical physics. And that also was my impression when I then, in preparation of the essay, went through the literature and tried to find maybe some papers where this has been done. And except for the few I cited, there's nothing, unless I have overlooked an important paper. But so far, I published this paper on the archive. So far, I did not get a feedback that some relevant paper was overlooked. So it seems really that people working on this unified series have so far neglected this altogether. I agree fully with what Penrose writes.
Okay, so it hasn't really affected people very much at this point. I think we've talked about what a theory of everything is. I think we've talked about just about everything we need to talk about with the undecidability. The part of undecidability, or the kind of undecidability that you're looking at, the spectral gap or the continuum hypothesis, that's the thing we want to look at. I just would like to know, is there something in particular about the mathematical structure of the standard model or theories of everything or symmetry or however people tend to think about theories of everything? Is there something in there that you think is particularly amenable to an undecidability theorem sort of approach?
You mean already in the standard model and the classical, before you go to the unified C theories on Euler-Lubin equation and the like? As far as I understand, it all has to do with this results about the undecidability of the gap in the spectra. And I mean, you have also in the standard model, although I have not investigated that, was functional versions of these quantum mechanical equations, where also this proofs of demonstration of qubit and also apply. So I think as long as you base the standard model on a space-time continuum with where you need regularizations and minimalizations, you have this issue. But in a sense, I mean, already this, but this is my personal impression, already this need for regularization and minimalization reminds me or below undesirability. Because you cannot calculate, I mean, the mass of, in this series, the mass of the electron or the charge of the electron. They are just inputs from experiment. And you have these infinities that somehow you can swallow up by redefining the charges. No? So you have a what is called a naked charge that is infinite. And then you have these mathematical infinities, and both of them together are just crude in a very clever way to get the experimentally found number. So although this has probably nothing to do with Gödel, it's also already a kind of an incompleteness that you have. And some of the older generation of the physicists, the pioneers of quantum mechanics, they, for this reason, rejected this quantum field theory with this regularization, because they thought this is just some mathematical magic trick and not yet the physics. So also Pauli and others, they made remarks on that. And so Dirac, very interestingly, he worked also on quantum gravity in the 1950s. He had important operatory work for what was later, but in the 1960s, he stopped. And the last paper of Dirac I found, very intrigued with that, just ended abruptly with statements saying, okay, we have these infinities, and in quantum gravity, we have, there are so-called delta functions that Dirac himself introduced, but he could show that if I make a calculation one way, I get a result, and I do the same calculation the other way, I get a different result. So he said, okay, as long as we do not understand the mathematics of that, I cannot go on. He just stopped, no reference whatsoever. And during his lifetime, I think he died in 84, it did not return. So in a sense, all of these problems so far had one way or the other to do with infinities, and that we cannot really derive from the standard model important parameters such as masses and charges. Obviously you can compute them from the fundamental theory, right? But then you come at those undecidabilities that I described in the essay, unless it's really discrete. So it seems, I mean, this is a century old discussion between discrete and continuous. I did not mention this in the essay, but I think it goes back to the ancient Greeks, no? They had the atomists like Democritus and so on, and you had philosophers, I think from the Stoa, the Stoistic philosophy, that were in favor of this continuum. And this kind of dichotomy and struggle goes on over all these centuries, so the Renaissance and so on, modern physics. And it seems it's still with us when we want to construct a final theory. So this old dispute of the modern 2000 years ago seems to play a role in discussing the relevance of a series of everything. That I find really amazing.
That is amazing. And actually, I think that's a perfect place to end. Right there. That's. I think that'll get everybody interested in
and think about it and work on it,
and hopefully they'll work on it. Yeah. I'd like to thank you very much for coming on.
Yeah,
I think a lot of people will be downloading your paper after this.
You have just listened to episode number 76 of Physics Frontiers: Undecidability and Theories of Everything with Klaus Kiefer. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/76. Show notes include the paper we read for this podcast, as well as related episodes of Physics Frontiers and other papers that we may have mentioned, as well as a couple of books that I believe we mentioned. It's been a very, very long time. I'm very sorry about that, and I'm very, very happy to see you here. Thank you very much for waiting, and thank you for being here. I've got another couple of episodes recorded, so we should have a couple more months together at least. Bye now.